Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the show. My name is Nathan Nkama from Dallas, Texas, and we welcome you to today's show wherever you're listening us, to us from Africa, Europe, Asia, the Pacific, Australia, New Zealand, and of course those in continental USA. I'll be hosting you from Dallas, Texas, and we are extremely excited about today because of what we have lined up, and we thank you all for joining us and choosing to spend your weekend with us. What we have on the show this morning, let me just mention to you the things that we're going to be talking about and discussing and who all our guests are. In this segment, which I'm going to be your host, we're going to be talking to Mr. Mark Chona. I consider Mr. Chona to be one of Zambia's celebrated civil servants, and he has served his country and is a patriotic Zambian. So we'll be talking to Mr. Chona in this first hour of our first segment, and I trust that it's going to be an exciting discussion, and everybody is ready and looking forward to this. And then in our second segment, which will be hosted by my good friend and good Zambian, Roger Charlie from Canada, is we're calling it A God in Zambia. Most of you have probably seen an email that has been circulating, which was written by an American student who visited Zambia, and he had some experiences there, and he decided to put them in writing through a blog. He's a former student. Well, I would like to say a former student at the University of Miami, and he posted his experiences on that blog, and he talks about a lot of things. And then within that segment, we are going to be also be talking to a good friend and a Zambian as well, Sidik Gelu. He is the president of the Association of Zambians in Atlanta. So we have an exciting show, and we're looking forward when they're glad. Once again, I want to say welcome and thank you for joining us. Let me recognize my friends who have already called in so far. Roger, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Nathan. How are you?
I'm doing good, my friend. It's good to have you on the show with me. Let me go to area code 613. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Mwate Mulenga calling
you. Mwate, it's good to have you again. How are you doing today, my sister?
I'm very good, thank you. And how are you?
Good. Are you ready for Mr. Chona?
Yes, I am.
Good, good. 678, good morning.
Good morning. This is Victor Mwaba calling from Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, you made it, my brother.
I made it for a few minutes. I'll be leaving in 15, 20 minutes.
Okay,
all right. Okay, Victor, you're welcome. It's good to have you on the show. I'm going to make sure you'll be the first person to ask the question.
What an honor.
Yeah, so that we just recognize the little sacrifice you are making to be with us. Well, ladies and gentlemen, and all the ladies out there and gentlemen listening to us, like I've said, we're going to be talking to Mr. Mark Chona. As I earlier said in my remarks, I consider him to be one of Zambia's celebrated civil servants. He served as an advisor to First Republican President Dr. Kaunda as a political affairs and international security policy special assistant for 28 years. That was a very great achievement. Let me welcome somebody calling on 763. Good morning.
Good morning, Titus Natala, Minnesota.
Oh, Bon Natala.
Yes.
How are you doing this morning, my friend? Up there in the upper north of North America.
Doing good. Everything is okay. We are not complaining.
That's good. Excellent. Excellent.
Evening, people around the world.
Mm-hmm. Miss Mwate, how has been your week?
Interesting. A lot of work, but the last 2 days have been really rainy.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I hear. So I hear the Eastern Canada has been very rainy.
Yes.
Okay. You know, you guys, we could do with some rain in this part of the world, you know. Roger is always laughing at me. I'm talking about the 90 degree temperatures in Texas. We are hot here and we don't play. Victor, how are things in Alabama?
Alabama is really nice right now. It's in the mid to upper 80s, so it's a beautiful weather for a good walk.
Excellent, excellent. So, like I've said, we'll be talking to Mr. Chona, and I consider him to be a very distinguished and celebrated civil servant, serving in one position for 28 years. I would like him to tell me how he did that in Dr. Kaunda's government. And one of the major news that we sort of took note at Zambia Block Talk Radio is the recognition of Dr. Kaunda. He was honored in Johannesburg, and he was given that award for his contribution towards the liberation struggle in Southern Africa. And another international world statesman, as one news media put it, Dr. Nelson Mandela turned 91. Roger, can you envision yourself at 91 years old?
That is a very, very long project, brother, to think about.
Titus, 91?
We don't think in those long terms in Zambia. We think 1 year at a time.
1 year at a time.
Yeah.
You need to be looking at that and
I know.
See,
I know. For some reason, I don't know if it is the way we were brought up as young kids. I don't know if everyone feels this, but in Zambian context, we don't like thinking about things in 5 year, 10 year, and later on 91 years old.
Hello.
You know? I could be wrong anyway.
That's interesting. Let me ask Victor Mwate whether they've seen that email about a god in Zambia. Did you see that, Victor?
Yes, I did. I made a couple of responses to a few discussion groups here and there.
In the email, in the Zambian blogging world.
Yes, sir.
Mwate, the god in Zambia.
Yes, I did. I didn't respond to it when I saw that you have that as on discussion. Contribute to that, but I definitely saw it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be a very exciting and heated debate, I must say. I've actually, for your information, ladies and gentlemen, I've read through it like 3-4 times. And if I printed the whole thing, and if you see the way I scribbled my sheet of paper, I'm almost inclined to almost get into that discussion. But we shall reserve that for the second segment. Let me welcome Mr. Chona to our show. And just by way of introduction, Mr. Chona is the chairman and chief executive of Sumika Consultancy and Management Services. And like I mentioned in my opening remarks of this show, that he served as a special assistant for political affairs and international security policy for the president from 1968 to 1980. And Mr. Chona is also a member, and he's on the board of directors also for the the Center for Foreign Relations. He is also chairman for an NGO which is called Matantala Rural Integrated Development Enterprise. Mr. Chona, thank you for joining us and welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, wherever you may be.
Thank you, sir. My name is Nathan Nkama, and I'm going to be your host for this morning. And my first question is, I was telling my colleagues that I consider you to be a celebrated civil servant. You've saved your country. How did you manage to do this in 28 years, sir?
I think really, in a way, it was an opportunity offered by President Kaunda allowed us to join the civil service before independence. There are three of us who became district officers straight from university, which was the campus of the University of London, which was then in Salisbury during the federal days. He wanted us to learn the tricks of administering districts in those days. And I think I served in Pelham immediately after university. I served for 8 months before going off to Cambridge for public Cambridge University for public administration, and came back. Was posted to Katete as district officer, and before I enjoyed my job, which I was really starting to do, I was withdrawn to go to the American University in Washington to study international relations and diplomacy. And that's how I got trapped into the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, first as the first Zambian permanent secretary in the ministry to set it up. I took over from a British team. And after that, of course, there's now really what else could you do? You worked under a very tough man who demanded a lot, President Kaunda. But he was a father figure because he made good decisions, which made it easy for us to pursue. So really it was that fortune which I had of having a number of scholarships to study, abroad. I'm a Canadian and a Munalian too, where I did my Form 6 in Munali also. So that's my background. And the rest really was the challenges that were unfolding as I grew up. Because I became permanent secretary of foreign affairs just before I was 31.
Wow.
So that's how young we were, and I was advisor to KK at 34. So that's really what happened.
Yeah, we can tell from the brief breakdown that you've given us that you became exposed to huge responsibilities at a very young age. Formulating foreign policy for Zambia and the negotiation that led to independence of Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Namibia, which was basically the foreign struggle. Just highlight for us briefly what those responsibilities entailed.
I think, first of all, really, it was the call of the time that our leaders, the OAU in those days, made a decision that we would not feel independent until the rest of Southern Africa was liberated. And it was from that standpoint that all the foreign policy formulations had to actually radiate. And it didn't really matter what strategies we are adopting or the tactics. The goal was very clear: to help Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Angola, and particularly because these were security issues for Zambia. And Angola alone, the border was over 1,000 kilometers, Namibia over 200 kilometers, Zimbabwe over 700 kilometers, Mozambique over 400 kilometers. And Malawi had a problem with Malawi because of their policy. And the Congo over 2,000 kilometers was unstable, sometimes almost hostile. So we really just had Tanzania. So we had to make sure that these countries were liberated. The next was really a matter of tactics, whether the freedom fighters were sufficiently equipped to pursue battles that would make it justified for Zambia to make even more sacrifices. So to make sure that the sacrifices Zambians made were commensurate with the prospects of success by freedom fighters. And when it was difficult, we did some other tactics and appear to be talking to the enemy while we get the freedom fighters training and more equipped. So those determinations were very, very difficult. And also after the border closure, that became even much more difficult Because as you know, when the border was closed in 1973, the oil shock also came. And also the metal prices came down. And all those, together with the liberation struggle, conspired against President Kaunda and his team's determination to implement the National Development Plan. And that was a very, very difficult time. So we had literally to ensure that the Security Council always understood the dangers which we were actually facing. The OAU understood and supported us. The Commonwealth, where we had greatest difficulties because Britain was responsible, particularly for Zimbabwe, and had a lot of influence on the Portuguese and the Americans and the French, were always either abstaining or voting against the resolutions which were proposed. So it was a very, very difficult time. But the most important thing was to keep track of where we were going, no matter what the difficulties were. So formulating the tactics for each meeting, giving the president the right briefs and the position papers for every meeting, that was a very, very big challenge. And that is, fortunately, having done international relations and diplomacy for a year, that helped very, very much, because I knew what a position paper was and what a fallback position was. So at least we could draw all those for the president, who was extremely helpful in encouraging us to think even more.
It looks like your career has been characterized by dealing or handling difficult situations. Let me fast forward before I go to my colleagues who are holding on to ask questions. Let me first fast forward the time to 2002. The Zambian parliament decides to revoke second president's immunity, and a task force is set up. You are picked as chairman. How did that process go? Were you called to State House? Did you get a phone call? And what were the terms of reference for the task force?
I did get a phone call to see the president, and who asked, whether I had any experience of recovering stolen assets. I didn't have that experience, but I knew how it could be done, because there was so much information in those days as to what was happening to copper, cobalt, and oil. So the information was actually flowing all the time, because whatever happens, intelligence services always collect information from the public, whether it is in bars or in banks or in shops and so forth. So there was plenty of information, the wrongdoing that was actually happening, and where possibly the assets could be. So I agreed to see what we could do in terms of mobilizing resources, because it's extremely expensive to recover stolen assets, because they're not in Zambia. A lot of the most expensive are not in Zambia, they're overseas. So one had to work out a method, and that's where diplomacy was very helpful, that at least I had contacts in the world where I could ask questions on how it is done. And having done international security, I met a lot of international security people. So it was easy to ask the right questions to the right people and to help us guide our way through the jungle of assets that had been lying wherever they were, thankfully the response was good, and that's how we proceeded to look at who was it. But for me, I found these cases, they had already started even before I arrived. The investigations had already actually started, except that the overseas investigations had not yet started, because those were extremely difficult. And after that, of course, it was a matter of selecting, prioritizing. And that is where we got in difficulties, because people sometimes confuse prioritization and selective justice. and you couldn't take over all the cases at the same time with a very, very small staff, which the task force had. As I always said, you know, that the team that was investigating the case against the Shabby Sheikh in South Africa was much bigger than the entire task force officers. And whether it is a battery of lawyers or investigators. And then you also had another difficulty, not only the size of the task force to handle cases of such magnitude and complexity, you also had the experience which our people had not yet acquired. The investigative capacity had to be built. It was not like another case where the police, you know, find an incident in the morning, in the evening, they make an arrest, or even a bank robbery, where, you know, they steal today, within 2 days, people are living ostentatiously, and they are caught. This is very difficult, and there is no parallel in Zambian history where these cases have been dealt with. So it was the first time for the officers, first time even for the magistrates, first time for many, many people. Even for those who were accused of plundering. So that is the experience which I then found, and then we started training, prevention, collaboration with overseas agencies. So that's how we proceeded. It was risky, it was difficult, but because it was difficult, we couldn't say we give up. As other countries have shown, whether it is Nigeria, South Africa, and many others in the world, which I won't mention, all of us, believe me, who have dealt with these cases, faced exactly the same position. And at meetings, we found it. We experienced the same risks, the same dangers, the same hatreds, the same hates. And it's normal, but you have to understand in Zambia that there are 12 million people. This is the few that are actually there in difficulties. And it hasn't finished, because even now, my colleagues, and I left in 2005, my colleagues still continue with the mandate, the 10-year period of Chiluba's rule. They haven't finished. There are so many other cases which I won't comment on. Mm-hmm. But even our colleagues in the ACC have still the same problems. Even currently, you can see the number of cases and how complicated they are.
That's true. So we have taken note that we cannot discuss or talk about certain things which are in the courts of law.
Please,
we are,
yes.
Those who are joining us, we are talking to Mr. Mark Chona, CEO and chairman of Usumika Consultancy. He also serves on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's a board member there. He's also the chairman of Matantala Rural Integrated Development Enterprise. Let me go to the phone lines. I'll go to, please let's introduce ourselves and which part of the world or country we are situated, so that Mr. Chona knows who he's talking to and where you are. 678, please go ahead, introduce yourself and ask the question to Mr. Chona.
My name is Victor Mwaba. I'm calling from Birmingham, Alabama in the United States. Good morning or good afternoon, Mr. Chona.
Good morning, good afternoon, sir.
My question is, when Zambia was getting involved in the liberation of pretty much the whole Southern African region, were there any economic considerations in addition to just the noble consideration of human dignity to make sure that our neighbors are liberated? Were there any economic considerations to say if Zimbabwe gets independent, Zambia is going to gain so much trade with Zimbabwe, and how much economic cost would Zambia put on that?
Now, I'm most grateful you asked that question, but please, just before I answer, can I just make a correction on my relations with the Council on Foreign Relations?
Yes, sir. Sure.
The technical description is that I'm a member of the International Advisory Board of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Thank you, sir.
I like that to ensure that the Americans don't think that I'm actually on the actual national board. No, thank you very much. Please, it is, you know, when you are fighting a war, sometimes the immediate economic considerations don't really play that much of a prominence. You are really looking at the benefits of the result afterwards. So I think those who were strategizing, like us, knew that at the end of it all, regardless of the bitterness, there would be benefits coming later, but not immediately. But we knew that when peace was established in Southern Africa, number one, it would be guaranteed of the southern route. And because every time we were facing that situation, there was this problem of threat of economic strangulation by Ian Smith and his cohorts. And we knew that when the liberation of South Africa was really, really intensifying, the South Africans will also do the same, and the Portuguese will do the same. So the question which I always use to ask my young people is, which is better for us, the old people now, to drink the bitter coke, or do we let our children take the bitter coke instead? Because that war had to be fought. If it was not fought at that time, it was going to be fought by you people now, and it would be more disastrous. So the immediate economic considerations, quite frankly, we could not actually think of them because we were struggling to survive during that period. As for whether or not Zambia would actually benefit, that would not depend on government. It would depend on the business community to take advantage of the new environment which was going to be created by the liberation of these countries. And I think that I remember President Kaunda in 1974 in Dar es Salaam made the statement which was quoted later about establishing a transcontinental belt of independent countries from Dar es Salaam and Lorenzo Marques in the east, in the Indian Ocean, to Rwanda in the Atlantic Ocean. And it is this transcontinental belt of independent, liberated countries that eventually emerged into SADC. And this is a statement which was quoted by Simba Makoni, as Secretary General of SADC. And when you drafted the statement in 1974 on a flight from Lisbon to London, that's where I put that statement in. And then you hear somebody quoting it, you understand that, gee, you didn't know that sentence was so important. So that is how I would answer the question, because political leaders sometimes don't make decisions in order that their people may actually benefit immediately. But that later on, the opportunities would actually open up, as they have done, thank God.
Thank
I don't
you,
know
sir.
I've answered the question, sir.
Yes,
Victor,
sir.
You are free. You are free to ask a follow-up question since you're believing.
Okay, thank you very much. My next question is concerning the fight against corruption. Much as I do understand, it's difficult to decide which case to start on. You know, whichever case you prioritize, there's going to be people who think you are selectively prosecuting them.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. What direction? What was the direction of the prosecution to say, if we start from this regime, we're going to go to another regime, or if we start from a certain amount of money stolen, we're going to go to another segment of, you know, certain amount of money stolen? What was the further direction to diffuse the idea of selected prosecutions? Was there any idea to diffuse that that impression?
I'm not quite sure, first of all, the definition of regime, you know, going from one regime to another, because we were only given a mandate, 10-year mandate. And it is within that particular period. The rest of the cases were for the ACC, and it was really during that 10-year period. And the cases that were actually immediately under consideration of ZAMTROP, and but then unfortunately ZAMTROP, you know, was like a stream. Then you bomb back, the flows move into different directions in different countries, and sometimes you meet another case, which the solution of which will help you solve all the others. And that delays, because you are such a small organization, that delays the other cases. As you try to finish the investigations on this particular line which you have hit, which probably has more resources which you are looking for. Sometimes you find a case in London which you are following leads you to properties in Zambia, or they lead you to properties in other countries. So all those meant that the cases which looked very, very interesting to people had to be delayed, because you are very, very few, as I said. And even among the few, some of the officers are not the most effective. So again, you know, you had to allocate your human resources to where you would actually make a maximum impact to finish the cases so that you can go to the next. And I agree that it's very difficult to actually make those decisions, and there are always risks of selective justice. But what is important, I think, for investigators all over, and I've met many in Latin America and Europe and Asia, and they are exactly the same. The risk of being misunderstood is always there. And you are always conscious that you will, but you have to make a decision like presidents do, whether they go to war or they don't go to war. And that is really what directs you. But selective justice, honestly, didn't exist. Now, I accept that if we had proceeded to give up on Dr. Bulaya's case, that, yes, I think would have been accused of selective justice. Because you leave a case which is very clear, and then you go for the others. But I think that the task force, thankfully, with the help of the president, decided to go ahead.
Excellent. Thank you, sir. Let's continue with our colleagues on the lines. I'm going to move to Canada. Area code 613, please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chona. My name is Moa Temlenga.
Good afternoon, Mama.
Calling from Ottawa, Canada. My question.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir. My question is, the position that Zambia took in the liberation of Southern Africa as a frontline state and all the sacrifices that Zambia made, you said the economic consideration was not a priority. The priority was to liberate Southern Africa. I think you would agree with me that the price Zambia has paid has been very, very heavy, and that compared to other issues has pushed Zambia. I was old enough in Zambia in the 70s to see and enjoy Zambia, and I've seen Zambia go from up there to slide all the way down. Would you say that the way forward, we can see Zambia up to a position that we were at in the 70s? Economically, socially, are we ever going to get there? Are my children, grandchildren, going to enjoy what I once enjoyed in Zambia?
Yeah. First of all, I think it's important for me to be understood that the issue of economic considerations was important, but it was a choice. If we had pursued the line of Kamuzu Banda, whom President Machel always said delayed the independence of Mozambique by 10 years, but if President Banda had not adopted that position, President Tabora Machel always maintained, he wouldn't have paid the price which we did. If we had decided collaboration with South Africa, sure, you probably would have had an independent, an international airport built by the South Africans. the Malawians, you know, had. But that would actually have dragged the war. Your grandchildren would probably be fighting the war now. And there were economic considerations. That's why we were saying that sometimes it was necessary to appear to be talking to the South Africans. For the liberation of Mugabe, Nkomo, and others, I had to go to South Africa in 1974 to see Mr. John Foster, the Prime Minister of South Africa, to ask him to help us release the leaders of the liberation movements in Zimbabwe so that negotiations could start. For all the mistakes the South Africans made, at least the release of those freedom fighters, which would not have happened without talking to the South Africans, and that is out of economic considerations. That we sometimes, when you don't have the power to overcome the enemy, you retreat, as Jesus says, as in Luke, I can't remember what chapter, I think it's chapter 9. When the enemy is on the horizon and you believe that he is stronger than you, you retreat, reorganize, which is what we are always constantly doing. So I'm not quite sure whether we can say that we would have actually been better without the liberation of Mozambique, Angola, Zimbabwe, Namibia, and South Africa. I don't think, frankly speaking, we can say that we would have been better. And at that time, you know, also, please, the population of Zambia was about 4 million. And the revenues from copper, even if they were going abroad, the little that was being brought back was sufficient to cover some of the infrastructure projects which the President Kaunda and his colleagues built. I was one of the 100 graduates in 1964. But by the time you were talking about, there were thousands and thousands of you who had actually gone to all levels and universities. So I can say that I agree that there was a price to pay. But the price definitely is justified by the liberation which you actually have now. Otherwise, the bombs would have been falling even in the days when you actually decided to leave.
As for where we are going,
I believe that, frankly, we are positioned to actually succeed, even with the problem which we are facing now. The only problem which we have is that, you know, the civil service is unfortunately engaged in a terrible culture of stealing. And the result is that every single year, I mean, if you go back 10 years or even more, look at how much money Parliament has voted, add the donor funding, add the entire set of figures over the last so many years. Then you go into the rural areas and you ask yourself, where has the money gone? It has not reached the villages where I'm operating. And that is true whether you are in my relatives in Kasama, Kinsari, where I have some, or Western Province, where I have plenty. The conditions are exactly the same in the rural areas. Where has the money gone? That is the question which you should actually be asking. And we are asking it through budget tracking.
Thank you. That's a good debate right there. We are still in Canada. My colleague, area code 403, please go ahead.
Yes, Mr. McChona, it is a pleasure to have you on our show. My name is Roger Charlie from Alberta in Canada.
Oh, my God. Thank you, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. My question, actually, recently we had stories in the health ministry where people have been accused of stealing money. We don't want to comment on that. But it's like whatever happened in the investigation of the Chiluba people is not having any effect to other people who are coming. And therefore, the whole program seems to be futile. Where do we go? Where do we go? What are we learning from whatever happened to the other guys who have been investigated to to where we are supposed to be going right now.
Yeah. I think I agree with you, you know, that it is disheartening that the, although, you know, these are cases which I don't want to comment on, there are no deterrent sentences yet. And people are still appealing, that is their right. But what is really disheartening is that the young people, it is the young generation, so I'm sure younger than you, who are actually in the ministries now, who are engaged in these practices. And it is disheartening that they have taken this culture of stealing forward. The hope is that, as the government has been saying, that they will tighten the screws in those ministries. And it's not only the Minister of Health, I'm sure even if you went to other ministries, it will be the same. The levels may be different. And the answer really is to stop the money being stolen. And it is being stolen. Then, of course, there is the problem of a lot of money being returned at the end of the year because it hasn't been completely utilized. It is the inefficiency of the system, and the government, I'm sure, is busy addressing how to jack up the operations of the civil service so that the implementation can be even more effective. And then there will probably be less theft. And because the cases are taking long, years, and there are few lessons to be learned that if you steal, you end up in difficulties. But my sincere hope, you know, in my old age now, is that people will not make stealing and corruption a new factor of production. In those days, you know, we used to say factors of production, land, labor, and capital. Now we have added technology and information technology. Now there is theft and corruption are factors, is a factor of production now. And that must be stopped. And really, we depend on you people. And the point you have made is very, very important. People should understand that this is their country. If people are going to make stealing as really a source of wealth, then there's something wrong, and you are going to have an unstable country in future. And that is the one thing I pray that you won't have. And you are there, and in diaspora, you know what is happening. Even if in America now, 44, just in New Jersey alone, 44 people have been arrested. In England, the MPs were involved. But, you know, I don't want us to compare ourselves to somebody worse than us. And that is not a good model to build the future on.
Thank you, sir. That's an interesting statement you've made about corruption being another. Let me follow up a question on what Roger said. I'm quoting this from a paper presented by Mr. Charles Kafunda in Addis Ababa in November 2000. He mentions that the problem of corruption in Zambia has in a certain way or instances discouraged foreign direct investment. What would be your comment to that?
I think that the statement I have made only not too long ago, if I understand the statement well, is that foreign, if there is a lot of theft, people find that doing business in Zambia or any other country in a victim state, for example, is too expensive. Too high, the cost of doing business where there is corruption is too high. And that's why in one country, which I won't mention, many, many years ago, they used to put 5% non-taxable amount for oiling palms of people. Thankfully, I think they stopped that now. Because these foreign investors do genuine, some of the genuine want to invest. But when the cost of doing business through corruption is too high, then they do genuinely hesitate. And I met one of them not too long ago who said, no, I wanted to bring some money, but I'm not going to do it. But there are others who make things worse for us, and I want to make this point, that there are two sides to corruption, to grand corruption. There is the demand side, that people in what I call the victim state, like Zambia, do ask for bribes, and on a big scale. And what they do is the investors just add that on top. But there is a supply side, the bribers. And that's where all the African money is. The billions are actually in the countries that have people, companies, people who are actually bribing the public officers in Africa. And it is this problem of in asset recovery which we find extremely difficult, that the bribing countries are actually holding on to so many billions of money from the third world, from poor countries. And the legislation in those countries is very weak for asset recovery. And there's a lot of politics around because a lot of them thrive on stolen money from our regions. So even if the foreign direct investment is affected by fears of corruption and saying that, you know, doing business in Africa is too high, the cost is too high, there is the other element also of the bribers actually making sure that to win a contract, they must bribe somebody. So that is one of the difficulties which we have. And I think that if you look at the OECD countries, ask them how many have signed the protocols on corruption. Ask them how many have signed the UN Convention and protocols on corruption. The ratification rate is very low. This is because they enjoy the money from the victim states in Africa and elsewhere in the third world.
Interesting. We are talking to Mr. Mark Chona from Lusaka, Zambia. If you wish to ask a question, the number to call is 347-237-4270. Let me go back to the phone lines. My colleague in Minnesota, please go ahead. Titus.
Oh, Mr. Mark Chona, this is Titus Natala from Minnesota. I think
good morning, sir.
Good afternoon for you. I want to just draw you back to the other area of... I'm more interested in the assets that we have in terms of essential people that are experienced. We have quite a lot of people like you and other people. How can we make use of people like you in terms of using you to help us in all these other areas? Because what I see is that somebody used to be this and then they leave him alone and he's now doing this and that, and yet we still have the potential to have something that we can extract from your experience and the many others that are around. The other time we had Ngandu Magande, and when you discover the potential that most people, whether they are politicians or economists or farmers, I see to it that it looks like we are losing what we can get from you people that I experience. What would be your comment on that?
The temptation would probably be to say no comment. The admiration I have for the young people I talk to is tremendous. And very often, you'd be surprised just how much you know. But I don't know what the constraints are for applying all that knowledge and experience. And you know, for us, you know... just like I said to my family, I used to be a very active member in organizing weddings. Then I became a consultant, then now senior consultant. And now just being told there's a wedding, come. I'm irrelevant. So people are free to come and to ask questions, and we answer them. And we can only answer questions which people ask. And if they don't ask, then we sit back and see whether or not they want to get to start. Because I used to tell my teenagers was that the difference between you and me is that you have not been old before. And so I still say that, you know, there's a lot yes in old people, because a lot of what is really happening has happened before. Except that, you know, you add technology, you add information technology and all those other things. But otherwise, you know, people still need the food, they still need the housing, they still need the water. It's exactly the same thing which we found when we became independent. Those needs are exactly still the same. It is how they should be addressed. And that is where probably the problem is. The other one is I'm not really afraid to say that there are too many of us who are in politics to make money and not to serve the people. That I'm prepared to say. and that is really what is worrying. That is a very worrying factor. Otherwise, we have very intelligent people, honestly, and more educated than KK's cabinet. And so they should really do a good job. I think the problem is, do we have time to do a good job?
Well, let me commend you for your honesty in responding to that, sir. You wanted to say no comment, but you responded. The reason we have you in this show is because we recognize we have a lot to learn from you. Let me continue with the phone lines. Let me go to my colleague and friend in Atlanta, Georgia, 770. Please introduce yourself and ask a question to Mr. Chona.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mark Chona. This is Francis Chanda from Atlanta, Georgia, USA. The first one is really a comment before I ask my question. In my view, the slow pace in prosecuting cases has really contributed to the indifference in the fight against corruption. That's just my view. Coming to the questions,
yes,
I was reading, I think, sometime last week in one of the papers, you were quoted as saying that there is no parliamentary or legal statute in the establishment of the task force. Now, if that's...
No, it's not me, sir.
Hello?
It is not me. It is not me. Just to make a quick correction, it is not me.
Okay, it was Mr.
Chairman
for the task force. Yeah, okay, I'm sorry about that.
Yeah.
But if there is no legal statute in the establishment of the task force, when you speak of the mandate of the task force, you are basically referring to the presidential declaration of the task force.
Right.
If that's the case,
which quoted the Constitution.
Right. If that's the case, basically the task force has no legal mandate to prosecute any corruption cases. Isn't that the case? Those are my...
No, the Attorney General made it clear when Mr. Chiruba's team wanted me to be a witness in their case, that actually the task force was validly established as an interagency organization under a constitutional provision which the president quoted when he appointed me. There was a discussion, and he actually said this is what he is going to use. And as a senior lawyer state counsel, he said, that is what I'm going to use. And that's what he used. So the Attorney General did actually say, this is actually valid. And after what he said, they didn't ask me to appear to confirm that this is how the president actually constituted the task force. It is, they use either the ACC legislation or the police legislation or the drug enforcement legislation. That is what they have always used. So, but I won't like to get into those. But I want to comment on your statement about delays. You know, when I was leading the task force in November 2005, 73% of adjournments of the cases were by the Defense Council. 73%. And another 18 by the courts, and only about 9% by the task force. So the delays were tactical. There was hope that in 2006 there would be a regime change. I'm sure that. And there wasn't. So it's the defense have actually delayed the cases. And also take into account that in respect of President Yoruba's case, for eight months he was not available. He was ill. So during that period, the case could not proceed. So there are many factors which constitute to the delays. The other one is that the cases, yes, are complicated, and there's a very small team, and even the magistrates' diaries are full, because they are not only dealing with task force cases, they also have to deal with the other ordinary cases. If it was like in the UK where there's a commercial division, then it would be different, because those magistrates or judges would be designated to deal with those particular cases. But these judges, magistrates, you know, honestly work extremely hard, and it is tough for them. I just wanted to explain the delays. And the complaint is genuine that, you know, they've gone for too long. But there are valid reasons, unfortunately, why this has happened, practical reasons why this has happened.
All right. Thank you, sir. Let me move quickly. There are colleagues who've been waiting for a while. 952612. I'm getting to you, and I appreciate your patience. Let me go to Minnesota. Area code 763. I believe this is Mr. Munyimba. Mr. Munyimba, please go ahead. Ask your question to Mr. Chona.
Oh, actually, I'm just listening to the conference.
You are just listening. Okay. We appreciate you joining us, and it's always good to have you with us. Let me go to somebody on 952. You've been holding on for a long time. We appreciate your patience. 952, please go ahead, introduce yourself, and ask your question.
Hello, my name is Joe Natala from Minnesota, and I got a couple questions for Mr. Mark Chona. Firstly, what is the relationship between... Hello?
Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, what is the relationship between you and the late Maiza Chona?
Yeah, he was the only older brother I had.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. And the other question was...
Please, thank you.
Hello, the other question has to do with the way we as Zambians get treated once we get back home. Having lived in these foreign countries for a long time, we expect to be welcome when you're at home, but then it's kind of frustrating sometimes when you are there at the airport, you know, after a long flight, just landed in Zambia, and then you see some foreigners, you know, being treated like VIP. They just, you know, go with their luggage and stuff, and then, you know, but when it's your turn, they put you on the side and start going through your stuff and stuff. I wish the workers back in Zambia knew the kind of experience we go through as foreigners. Would you comment on that?
Yeah. No, I do agree with you that sometimes our foreign friends, you know, particularly white, non-black, shall I say non-black friends, do receive better treatment. And probably they are assumed to be just visitors. And when you are arriving, maybe if people think you have come from Bangkok, you know, with your baggage or Dubai, and they would like to examine, because there are so many traders who are actually traveling coming from that direction. So maybe sometimes we are mistaken to be traders. And I must admit, it must be annoying if you are not used to. And my sincere hope is that as we just talk about diaspora, the customs people will actually understand, because they should be well trained enough to look at the face and say this one is not a trader from Hong Kong. And they do know the Zambians who go to Hong Kong and Bangkok and all, Dubai and all these other places anyway. So they should be able to be kind. But at the same time, it must be difficult for an officer, you know, sitting there trying to identify who really may be carrying baggage which is dutiable. But I can't say anything more but just to express my understanding of the frustration when you are greeted by that attitude right at the airport. We can't win. When we are there, you now have to take off my shoes and socks. And when I'm traveling in the United States and when I come here again, I still have to go through the same kind of treatment, which is not fair. I hope that there will be an improvement as we discuss now.
The issue actually to everybody that Joe has raised, in our next segment, Mr. Chona, we are going to be discussing an article which was written by an American student who visited America. It's entitled The God in Zambia. It's particularly talking about our attitude towards the foreigners and towards ourselves. So, Joe, you are right on target, and I hope you join us in the next segment. We are really going to talk about that seriously. I think it's a terrible stigma on our part that a visitor comes into the country and is able to make that observation about the way we treat each other.
Yeah.
All right, let me proceed.
Right.
Area code 612, I believe this is Pastor Kaluwe.
Yes, sir.
Please go ahead and ask your question. Thank you for joining us.
I don't have a question at this time. I'm listening to gain wisdom from others.
it's humbling to hear.
He's a very wise man.
Yes, I agree, Mr. Chona. It's especially from a minister of the Word of God to make a statement like that. Mr. Chona,
can you just allow me, please, about a God in Zambia?
Please, sir.
I read the article, and it has been speculated. We don't know whether that man is a white man or a Zambian writing fictitiously. But whatever he said, the one thing, quite frankly, which I have picked is lack of self-esteem and self-worth, which for me are the basis for mutual respect. Because you can't enjoy mutual respect when you don't have self-esteem and self-worth yourself. And those of you who have lived abroad, those guys, you know, some of you, you beat a lot of them in class, because I did. So they can't be better than us. And they can't be better than us. And it genuinely annoys me when I think of that. I work with Professor Goma, and we had a very good story of a consultant who was his classmate, and who came here and asking, "What are you doing?" And this is what I'm doing. He says, "No, but that's what I have come to do." He says, "But I did a paper, you know, a long time ago on this subject." He says, "Give me the paper." He was given the paper. The man went to Livingstone at the Victoria Falls, changed the first page and the last page, reorganized the pages, came back and gave it to the minister, and the minister looked and says, "Oh, this is exactly what we wanted." And yet,
you know, Mr. Chona,
and
you are provoking me to start talking about that God in Zambia article. What you have said, you know, I'm going to reserve my comments for the next segment. Personally, I see a lot of exaggeration. Honestly, all guys, ladies and gentlemen who have read that article, you mean people who stand there looking at you, tabaku eten chito, they don't have work to do. That is very disappointing. Do you have any question for Mr. Chona before we start talking about what's coming up next?
The only question is the trend of corruption in Zambia. Like you, Mr. Chona, you've been there, worked in government that long. How do you see the trend? Are we getting worse, getting the same, getting better? how have we done from independence to today, like in 10-year segments?
That is in terms of corruption.
Yes, in terms of corruption.
Yeah.
There was corruption before independence, there's corruption now, but what are the levels? How are we doing?
Now that the youth, you know, have joined, as exemplified by the Ministry of Health, and I'm sure that it is happening elsewhere, your challenge is greater than it was before. As you know, President Kaunda, when he came into power, the first 2 years, he sacked ministers for corruption. And then that's why he tried to introduce the leadership code. As a measure. As soon as that was removed, it was free for all. And now I can only use the prayer, please, that you people who are observing from outside, the more you speak about the need to put Zambia on track for development, the better for all of us. But for the moment, I think that if God stopped the world at midday and said, you people, diaspora, go into every ministry and check what has happened, and go to the private sector as well and check what is happening, you'd probably be shocked, because there's so much that is not good, and the ACC is very, very small to deal with that kind of thing. You can even see our young people, you know, overseas being arrested for drug offenses. It was there before, but I think it's getting worse. And we just have to make an appeal to say, let us put a stop to this. That is my sincere hope. And it means my trust is in you people who actually are feeling it. And being abroad, you know, you see your country being mentioned from time to time, you feel very bad. And even for us, you know, who are working, I had to shut a meeting up one day when they said, oh, Africa, it's a hopeless case. I said, but I know some of your leaders who have been involved in this, and I can mention by name, and you are keeping our money. And so we do have to fight. We shouldn't give up, because if we do, then you will recall, and I'm glad that the pastor listening, all it takes for evil to triumph is for good people to remain silent, it is saying. So you can't stop. You just have to continue fighting, drawing our attention, those of us who are here, and say, keep on fighting. Because if you do, then the mafias will actually take over the country. And you know what happens when they do.
Before we switch gears, I'll just make a few statement contribution to what you've said, Mr. Chwana. I've always said war is business. And I always get in trouble for saying that.
No.
Go ahead. Money. Mm-hmm. War is business. Whether people agree with that statement or not, war is business. Talk to us about Matantala Rural Integrated Development Enterprise.
No, please, I'm most grateful for this opportunity to talk to you. It is the poverty levels which have been increasing despite year after year cabinet passing budgets and parliament approving them. And at the end, it doesn't matter where you go, as I said at the beginning. There is no evidence of visible development. In schools, in health institutions, in infrastructure, exactly the same. So we have been answering the question, why isn't the money getting there to the target areas, to the poor? Poverty is worse than it was before. Number one, because the populations are growing up. So urban poverty and rural poverty is intensifying because the population is growing. The capita is reducing because the population is going up, production is either static or going down. So this is why we decided, fortunately, with the support of the Norwegians, to launch Matantala as a rural integrated development. Since 2007, when we actually started the construction program, we have done 79 classrooms in 27 schools. We've built teachers' houses. We've done 4 clinics and clinic staff houses. We built 22 deep tanks, and are still going on. And the women's movement, the women are getting little loans as low as 500,000 kwacha. They have been able to take off, and they're doing very, very well. We fought suppression, and the men now do accept that suppression has been the number one problem in the 3 chiefdoms which we picked. And that is Chief Hanjariga, Chief Mwanza, and Chief Chona. Because, in a way, this is an old program which I started many, many years ago, but I didn't have any funder. When the Norwegians came, we've been able to do what we're doing now. It is replicable, and people are asking us, can you please establish this same program in another chiefdom, in many parts of Zambia? They are asking us to help. But it is dependent on what you do with that resource called headmen and their chiefs. That is what we are using. The moment you train the headmen, they understand the problem, they do community mobilization. We have been building schools at the fastest possible rate. At the first 2 classrooms, two blocks of classrooms, we did them in 2.5 months. 4 villages came on Monday, Tuesday, another 4 came on Wednesday, Thursday, another 4 came Friday, Saturday, SDAs came on Sunday. And just sheer organization, mobilization, people are willing to work. And we are very proud of what we've been able to do. So we do have now a workshop in September. The Norwegian team from other countries is coming to actually study what we are doing and how we are doing it. It's part of the governance. The moment women are no longer suppressed, the orphans are not suppressed, the old men are not suppressed, even our old villagers, able-bodied, they are suppressed by people who come from town to buy maize at the lowest possible price. That's a form of suppression. So we are fighting that through education to wipe out ignorance, disease, to wipe it out, corruption, exploitation. So that is how we are actually moving. And I hope that please, one day you can visit our website, which requires a bit of updating, because we've been fighting HIV/AIDS. On the 1st of April, we had an HIV test. You know how many people came? KK said 9,000. I said, no, Gaga, please, it must be 7,000. And I announced that I would go to test myself publicly, and I'll tell you the result. The following day, 3,500. By the time we finished the program for 2 days, we had done 1,024, 99 of whom were positive. Now we are answering the question, what do we do with the 99 plus, wherever they may be? And also we are encouraging production. We just had an agriculture and a commercial show in a rural area, deep, deep in the rural area. You'll be surprised when people talk about economic diversification. It's happening. We saw a wooden sprayer, and it's unbelievable what people are able to do. The talent which is sitting there, which has no market, is amazing. So those are some of the things which we are doing in a nutshell. And please, whatever you do, think of home in the diaspora. You can do a lot with your influence and your ability for resource mobilization.
Well, let me take this opportunity to, I'm going to put a friend, a lady on the spot. Mwate, I'm going to ask you to thank our guests. Could you please do that?
Sure. Mr. Mark Chona, thank you very much for giving us your time and sharing your wisdom and answering the questions as they've been posed to you. I believe you had no clue what we're going to ask because the host never asked us to, never checked with us to get what sort of questions we're going to ask you. And you did answer the questions very well, and you've given us something to think about. And probably, as the host said, getting into the next segment, I liked your comment about some of the non-African-looking arrivals in Zambia having preferential treatment? So, Mr. Mark Chona, and the program you're doing with the Matantala Rural Integrated Development is really, really recommendable, and we pray that the Lord will guide you and you keep up the good work. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mama. In the closing years of my life, that is what I would like to do, because at 75, I know that every day is playing in extra time.
Thank you. The host, can you allow me to add a personal note for Mr. Chona?
Please go ahead.
I was actually at school with Rose Chona at Roma Girls.
Oh, my God.
I was
you.
1 year ahead of her.
Thank you.
And I was amazed at the brother's treatment of Rose Chona when she was at school. They so humble, so I won't even go into details, but it was really amazing. Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Sir, we appreciate
your
time. Yeah, I think the Chona family have served their nation very well, and thank you for spending your weekend with us. We shall post Matantala Rural Integrated Development Enterprise website on our Zambia Blog Talk Radio so that everybody can look at it. And should you find it in your heart to do something about that, that will be very good, because this is about diaspora for development. Sir, have a great weekend, and we hope the best for you.
And please, God bless you also all the time. And please remember, Zambia, 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 we are 12 million now. In a few years' time, we'll be 15. And in another, we'll be 20. And please arrest the poverty situation. Is that, I challenge you. God bless you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Mr. Mark Chona, Chairman and Chief Executive of Sumika Consultancy and Management Services. He was Specialist for Political Affairs, International Security Policy from 1968 to 1980. And we all remember him as the chairman for the Task Force on Corruption and Plunder. Okay, now, coming up in the next segment, we're going to be discussing that dreaded email, a god in Zambia, which has upset and annoyed a lot of Zambians. And we encourage everybody to call back in, and that's what we're going to be talking about. Next week, one of Zambia's celebrated journalists, Frank Mutuvila, is joining us. We're going to be talking about press freedom and where we are in Zambia in that aspect. Now, let me get everybody's mind about our visit and discussion with Mr. Chona. Francis.
Well, it's been very enlightening, and I just hope we had more people like that with a heart for Zambia in leadership. Unfortunately, like you said, most of the people that are going into politics now are more concerned with their pockets than with the plight of Zambians.
Yeah, like saving the people. Joe, I'm really glad that you brought that point up, and it's interesting also that Mr. Chona read it. What did you make of that?
That was a very interesting comment. I was very happy, and like you know, I'm not on Block Radio that much. I think this is the second time for me to listen to it and all that.
It's okay, you did good.
I thought that was interesting, you know. Every single time I go to Zambia, I notice these things, you know, because when you live in a foreign country, you pick up on a lot of things. So a lot of times, you know, our so-called devazungos, they get away with a lot of stuff. So it can be kind of frustrating sometimes. You know for sure that you're going to be put aside. Even if you have just one suitcase, it's like, come on now. What's up with that?
Interesting. Roger, I know you are burning. You can't wait for us to talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing when you talk about
fire in the next segment.
Yeah, when you talk about old guys like him, you know, they bring all these Smith in Rhodesia memories, you know.
Mm.
It's exciting and sad at the same time, you know, to see how much our country, and like we are going to be talking about a god in Zambia, the writer, I think, forgets, you know, our influence in that part of the world, how much we have done for Africa, and yet he chooses to put our country and our culture down.
Yeah. You know, you're talking about him bringing back memories about Rhodesia and everything. You will be interested to hear this. You know, I've made friends with a police officer in the Dallas Police Department. This guy worked as a mercenary in the Rhodesia Army. He told me he was part of that team that landed at Lusaka Golf Club. You remember when they fired bullets in the that house near Lusaka Golf Club where they presumed Joshua Nkoma was living? This guy was part of that team. Every time he sees me, he just gets excited talking about the things they were doing. Anyway, it's a very interesting situation to talk to this gentleman. He talks about the things they used to do. It's amazing. Miss Mwate, what's your overview about this discussion with Mr. Chona?
I'm glad you brought him on, and indeed he has contributed a lot to Zambia, and it's really sad that we're positioned, we're landlocked. We needed the opening in the freedom in the region, but at the same time, as I said, I think we really went beyond, and in the process, we did more outside than inside, at the expense of inside.
Yeah.
And as we were working on the outside, we were slowly going down on the inside. I remember a time where just the essential commodities, people had to cross the border into Zimbabwe to go and get the essential commodities, and Zimbabwe was laughing at us. And today I've met some Zimbabweans who do not see what Zambia did for Zimbabwe, like for Zimbabwe's independence.
Yeah.
So I'm glad you brought him.
And you see, it's interesting. I mean, everyone just did good. You brought the discussion from a different perspective, Mwate. I mean, Roger also came from a different angle. Francis also brought it from another aspect. And amazingly for us, like Roger said, for us to talk about this and look at the memories and the experiences of, you know, those helicopter fighter planes flying over Lusaka and bombing areas where they thought the ANC or the freedom fighters were. And Titus, your perception about our discussion?
Oh, it's very interesting. It's very, very interesting. And Joe is my young brother. I just wanted to remind him that maybe sometimes these guys might jump on him because he is an American citizen. So sometimes these guys are more interested when they see an American passport. They're trying to figure out, they classify you into this same subject that we'll talk about, that Wazungu or whatever. So they'll start figuring out, they'll think you've been in America for maybe 20, 40 years just because of the passport. I mean,
but like Joe said,
he's only
got one suitcase.
Yes, I know that, but I'm just saying, you know, this subject that we have where people feel Wazungu is something else or whatever, money, they bound to try to go wrong, which is a wrong thing. You just have to watch it, like Mark Jonah mentioned. There's some things that you can look and tell that, you know, it looks like somebody is not comfortable. Maybe there's something else they have, you know, and maybe you can try to ask whatever you can ask based on that. Not every person, and then every other foreign person coming in, it's like they have all this VIP treatment. You don't even think anything, and that's where things can go, you know.
I hear what you're saying. Francis, aren't these just all trends or traits of a corrupt society?
I really don't think so. It's just that...
what is our problem?
If you look... I remember when I was growing up,
uh-huh.
milk was being delivered and left outside. and the shop owners wake up in the morning and check the new.
Now?
So if it's a trend, where did we go wrong? What happened?
Mm.
From a nation where a delivery truck could leave things outside and no one will pick anything until the owner opens the store. Today they can't even do that. Mm. Where did we go wrong? Where did the trend break from up at that time in the 70s? Where did the trend break? What happened?
But probably, where did we go wrong?
Right.
Can I answer that?
Yes.
Where we went wrong was pre-independence, independence, and early years in the 70s, the population was not as high. The system, the taxation system, you get one child, you get incentive, you get, I think, six children, I could be wrong, you're not taxed. So guess what happened? It's child and child and child and child. So we were not planning ahead for the growth of the population, but
uh-huh.
we were making the population grow.
On the contrary, Ms. Mwata Mulenga.
Yeah?
On the contrary, the bigger the population, the more booming the economy world over.
Yes.
So, yeah, with.
Yes and no. But it
No, let me give you this perspective.
Uh-huh.
If you are developing an industry,
uh-huh.
and in my view, that's the thought that the government at that time had. If you are developing industry, you need a market. And for you to have a market, the population had to be increased. If you go to Botswana, I worked in Botswana for 7 years. Because the population is only 1.5 million, it has been very difficult for the government to develop industry. What you have there are warehouses. Basically, Botswana is a trading nation because they cannot develop of their own based on the population that is there. So population is a driver of the economic development. But how do you plan for that? If you talk of lack of planning, I will agree with you.
Yes, it's population, but you should also have your resources. But what I'm trying to say is we increase the population way too fast to find that people are not, for instance, schools, people were dropping out, the pass rates went down, not because kids were not performing as well, but because there were not as many schools to cater for the population. So the population growth and the economic growth were not going together. Then stealing got on the higher side. I still remember, wow, there was a bank robbery. At one stage, that was unheard of.
Big
then
news, bank
bombing.
Robbery.
Pardon?
I'm saying it made big news, bank robbery.
Yes, it did. So really, we need the population for us to grow, but at the same time, we should have the resources. For instance, if I don't have, my income is so much, and then I have a choice to have one child or 10 children. I can feed one child, but the 10 children, if we're going to work in the field, we'll need the 10 children because there's more labor. But if I'm going to feed all the 10 children just from my income, I might not have enough. But if those 10 children can contribute to the generation of the food, then we need the 10 children. So really when I'm saying the population growing and the policies that we had, it's not that it was wrong for the population to grow. It was right, but we did not plan right. We did not prepare for the population to be what it is today.
But,
right.
Ms. Mate, a quick question as we break here. If our population by now is still 6 million people, do you think our situation will be any better?
I don't think so.
Oh, no.
I don't think so.
Sorry,
we do need the population.
Let's pick it up in the next segment. We can pick up the discussion before we get into God in Zambia. We are
right. Basically
running out of time. And please, everyone, call back in. Remember, 347-237-4270.
I do thank everybody for participating, and we're looking forward to an exciting discussion in our next segment. Let's all call back in the next few seconds. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.